Today is Wednesday. It's May 11th, 2022. It's 2:39 in the afternoon. And hi, it's John Williams. This is the Mincing Rascals, the podcast, which you can also hear broadcast in part Saturday nights from 8 to 9 o'clock. You can listen to me on WGN Radio weekdays from 10 to 2.
I'm Austin Berg from the Illinois Policy Institute.
I'm Heather Sharon from WTTW News.
And I'm Eric Zorn, the proudly pearl-clutching publisher of the Picayune Sentinel weekly newsletter and also occasional columnist in the Daily Herald.
And I think I know what you're clutching your pearls about there, Eric.
I'm among those who have been accused of clutching my pearls over my dislike of the tactic of protesting in front of the Supreme Court justices' homes in Washington suburbs. Yeah. I think it's a really bad idea, and people are saying that, oh, you've got it all out of proportion and you shouldn't be worried about, you know, civility and probity when you've got this terrible Supreme Court decision coming down. But I have several reasons why I'm opposed to that.
Last week, we talked about the leaked Supreme Court draft in which Justice Alito evidently is arguing that abortion is not, well, evidently we've read it, isn't sufficiently anchored in American tradition, and the no right to privacy protects a woman's unique opportunity to end an unborn life. Most Americans disagree with that. And Eric Zorn argued here last week that it doesn't even matter what most Americans think or what state legislatures want to do, that this issue, like an inalienable right, is not to be conveyed by the state. It is no more to be given than it is to be taken away. Those who would agree with that have been gathering in protest at the homes of the Supreme Court justices, or at least those that are voting that way. Incidentally, I understand that it has been found to be legal to protest at the homes of Planned Parenthood and abortion clinic providers at their personal homes. I don't like either proposition, and I don't suppose you do either, right, Eric?
I don't like any of those things. A couple of little changes there. They protested at John Roberts' home as well. Roberts apparently is not one of the five who signed on to Alito's draft opinion. And I am fully in sympathy with, as you point out, the protesters, what they're saying, what their cause is. I also want to be clear that this is something that I don't consider to be something that should be put to a vote. Obviously, it's important what people think, because this is going to be decided at the ballot box, no question about it. But So I concede that it matters. It just doesn't. I don't think that it should matter. I don't think this is something. I don't think we should vote on whether, you know, black people can drink at drinking fountains and so on. I think these are our rights, and I think that the woman's right to an abortion ought to be a right, not subject to a vote. But
I thought that's what I was saying. I'm not sure I understand the distinction. You feel that it's not subject to popular opinion or even a state law. It will be maybe, but it should not be, right?
It will be, but it shouldn't be. Yeah, I just want to make it clear that I understand that it is. I'm a realist about this. There are a whole bunch of cases about time, place, and manner restrictions on freedom of speech that have been through the courts. One of the earlier ones was Gregory versus Chicago, which is a 1969 case in which comedian Dick Gregory was trying to protest and picket outside the home of Mayor Richard J. Daley. And in that case, the court wrote that the sacred retreat to which families repair for their privacy is the home. It's the last citadel of the tired, the weary, and the sick. And then in a 1980 case having to do with picketing at the home of Michael Blandek, another Chicago mayor, the court wrote that the state's interest in protecting the well-being, tranquility, and privacy of the home is of the highest order in a free and civilized society. And, you know, I could argue about the legality of it. And apparently there's also a federal statute that is very specific about picketing at the home of judges. I think it's a tactic. It's a bad one. I think that it alienates people. I think that we don't want to go down the road of opening up people's homes as proper venues for protest. Because if you go down that road, suddenly really no one is safe. If someone disagrees with something you wrote on the internet and wants to, you know, bring people over in front of your house and march up and down and with signs and harass you and your family, they could do that. You could have other forces, as we've seen before with the anti-abortion protesters hassling doctors at their homes and nurses and clinic workers at their homes. What would happen if a marriage equality case comes before the court and then you have protesters outside the homes of some of Sonia Sotomayor? I just don't think we want to go there. I think we want to back off from that as a matter of tactics, and also I think as a matter of decency. I don't think we should be in people's homes.
I think Eric's point, two points I like. One is that sort of the opinion doesn't necessarily matter, but it extra doesn't matter in this case because of how little people understand about how the case really works and then how that interacts with state law. So there's a really interesting Fox News poll the Monday before the draft decision leaked. And it asked voters, do you think the Supreme Court should overturn Roe v. Wade or let it stand? So 27% of people said the court should overturn, 63% said it should not. So overwhelmingly, people are not in favor of overturning at that moment. However, the same poll asked if their own states should pass, quote, a law banning abortion after 15 weeks of pregnancy, which is exactly the sort of law, you know, that at issue in Mississippi. Dobbs.
And
54% of respondents said that their states should pass that law. So even when we talk about public opinion, it's difficult to parse public opinion on what, right? Exactly what policy, exactly what state should do, exactly what the court should do. But now that the issue is set to be potentially out of the Supreme Court's hands and will be decided at ballot boxes in states, I think Eric's point is correct that you really do have to look at the political tactics at play. And there will be folks on the right seeking to amplify the most extreme tactics on the left and vice versa. So I think in a sense, it actually has much more far-reaching consequences now than ever.
You mentioned it, and I think Eric mentioned it too, but it's specifically been upheld that protests are allowed outside the homes of doctors who perform abortions and abortion clinics. If you spend any time listening to the truly harrowing tales that those doctors can tell about what they have to go through to get to their jobs and to provide the care that their patients need, I am less than concerned about this issue.
Well, I would just second what you said about distractions. With the first week after this opinion came out, all the talk on the right was all about who leaked it, why did they leak it, and of course, we still haven't found out who leaked it.
Which is amazing.
It is kind of amazing, and whether they're actually going to investigate, or maybe they figured it out and it's an embarrassing answer and they don't want to talk about it. Who knows? But it was a complete distraction.
You think it's Jenny?
This is an earth-shattering development in the court, and to be worried about who leaked what a little bit early is really, really a side issue, as is, frankly, this issue of picketing at the homes of people.
Okay, but wait a minute. But it's a side issue, but it's an important issue.
Oh, I agree. I'm writing like 1,000 words on it in tomorrow's Picayune Sentinel. I mean, this is right in my wheelhouse. It's something that I feel is a legal and also a tactical, moral, ethical issue. You have to fight this tactically. You have to win hearts and minds, because as Austin points out, the polling on this is very interesting, and you're actually right. You'll ask people if they support Roe v. Wade, and they'll say, oh, yeah, I support Roe v. Wade, and then you'll dig down a little bit into what they actually think about abortion, and they tend to be much more in the middle, like, yeah, I'm okay with abortion up to a certain point, and then after that point, and maybe it's 15 weeks, maybe it's 20, maybe however you define it, but this is a issue that people are very conflicted about internally and as a society. So this is where the political strategy, electoral strategy, the big question for the fall is going to be, can Democrats and the left keep up this level of interest and anger and determination?
I think if it's legal, okay, fine. It's legal. You have the right to do it, but it's a bad strategy, right, Eric? I mean, you don't think that it's an improper judgment that they're allowed to protesters go to the homes of Supreme Court justices. You just think that's bad practice, right?
I think it's bad practice. And certainly there, I believe that there is a law. There's a federal law having to do with interference with the courts that is sort of on beyond First Amendment sort of things, which means like, yeah, you don't have a First Amendment right to go to the home of a juror in a trial.
Yeah.
To identify, you don't have a right to go out and walk out in front of their house with a sign. You don't have a right to go to a judge's house during a trial and demand that he or she rule a certain way, that the courts have a certain special level of protection from those sort of things. But as a general rule, though, they protesters gathered outside of Mayor Lightfoot's house. I didn't like that. They gathered outside the school board vice president's house a couple years ago. I didn't like that. They gathered a couple weeks ago in front of Len Goodman's house, the guy who was a co-owner of The Reader. I didn't like that either. I think these things should be fought on the public arena, not in front of private
homes. Well, go to the Supreme Court. Go to the building itself. Go to where they sit.
That's fine. Yeah.
You guys want to know a fun fact about that?
Yes.
The justices aren't there that much. Go ahead. So we'll be the judge of that, but go ahead.
So the prohibition on protesting outside the home of federal judges stems from the McCarthy era, and it was pushed through as part of sort of the McCarthyite sort of, you know, red baiting scare. And there was, you know, sort of, you know, purported, you know, threats to judges from, you know, fifth column, you know, communist protesters. So that's where this law comes from.
Is that right? And,
yeah.
That's pretty fun.
That is a fun fact, but it doesn't give me a lot of pause because I don't like, you know, here's something else. I don't like protesting outside courthouses when jurors are walking in like they did during the Van Dyke trial. I thought Van Dyke was guilty of sin. I did not like the people outside yelling and screaming at jurors walking into the courtroom. I thought that was really inappropriate. I'm clutching my pearls. If you guys could see me right now.
I wouldn't necessarily catch it as pearl clutching because it proves those who believe the leak is a really big deal correct in a way, because it could be seen as trying to intimidate justices before rendering.
Absolutely. So, or influence the midterm elections. Go ahead.
100%. And I think it would be a big story if the valences, the political valences were flipped and it was the court maybe reinforcing Roe and pro-life activists sitting outside of justices' homes and chanting all through the night. I think it would be a big deal would be made of it, and rightfully so. And I do think it does have political consequences.
Tactically speaking, I can't imagine right now a justice changing his or her vote. Of the five who have apparently signed on to Alito's opinion, it's hard to imagine any of them. Like Brett Kavanaugh, they protested at his home. What if he changed his mind now? He couldn't almost at this point because it's like he would be seen to be bowing to this pressure, people chanting outside his house. My guess is that this draft was leaked in order to create just this sort of atmosphere that would lock in those five votes, that it was motivated by someone who was afraid that Justice Roberts was going to pull somebody off that five vote majority and craft a much milder opinion with those five votes. I'm just guessing here, but Occam's razor, the simplest explanation is that, as far as I'm concerned.
Well, I think there's also a good deal of concern on the right that what's going to happen with Roberts in the Dobbs case, which would overturn Roe versus Wade, is what happened in the Obamacare case, because very famously, he voted to overturn Obamacare and declare it unconstitutional, and then literally at the 11th hour changed his vote and wrote a concurring opinion with the left wing of the court. There have been additional leaks since the full draft report or the full draft decision was released. And I think it's very clear from those leaks to the Washington Post and to Politico that this leak, from everything that we know, is directed toward Roberts in an attempt to get this decision to not be 5-4, but to get it to be 6-3. If it is 5-4, then you're going to see a lot of headlines be nearly evenly split court. That's another historical fun fact that, of course, the original decision, Roe versus Wade, leaked in 1973 before it was announced by the Supreme Court. So I am really unconvinced by not your pearl clutching, Eric, because I find your pearl clutching appropriate and on point, but all of the sort of the hand-wringing about the leak, it's unprecedented, how dare this happen? It's all happened before, it's all happened again.
Yet another fun fact is that this parts of this opinion, or at least the gist of it, was leaked to the Wall Street Journal like a week before it was leaked to Politico. The logic of getting the left all excited and angry before this decision comes out, if it was going 5-4 against them, it doesn't make sense. It doesn't make sense because I think, if anything, all the to-do, all the protests, all the anger has to harden opinions on the court.
And a 5-4 sticks as much as a 6-3 does. I suppose it'll sound a little...
If you're somebody like Chief Justice John Roberts, and all of the reporting that I've read about him is that his goal is to prevent the institutional support for the Supreme Court in the nation, to protect that. If you have a dissenting opinion from the Chief Justice saying that this is an inappropriate overturning of longstanding 50-year-long Supreme Court precedent, I think that plays differently than if you have a united right wing.
I get that. But that's his problem, and maybe all of our problem in the long run. But I mean, it doesn't change the outcome in any way.
No.
I don't know if you were here when we brought this up. We kind of change the players each week. But what does the panel think about what this does for Democrats or to Democrats in the upcoming election? Does this help at the state and local level, or does it hurt? I was of a mind that maybe this actually helps. It gets Democrats out. If it's going to be in the state's courts, then maybe Democrats will be more inclined to show up.
It really, really depends on the state. So, for example, in Illinois, where there's supermajority House and Senate, Democrat control and a Democratic governor, it's a long, long way away from passing anything.
What about a truly purple state? Wisconsin?
It could become a very contentious issue there. The increased attention on this issue goes both ways. There's very motivated folks on the pro-life side will be, you know, certainly motivated to get out to vote when they feel like their vote is going to have make a meaningful difference in a state's policy on abortion, as is the case with pro-life folks. So what I would expect to happen in many of these states, many of those safe states, is to use the most extreme thing said by Marjorie Taylor Greene or something like that, and make that a referendum in Illinois. Do you want that here or not? And I think the same will be true of the other side. So I think there will be a lot of scare tactics.
Gallup took a poll back in 2020, and they asked people who consider themselves pro-life and pro-choice, to use those terms, and the people who are against abortion rights, something like 30% of them said they were single issue voters. Like, this was the issue that mattered to them. And those who are in favor of abortion rights, it was 19%. Were single issue voters. Those kind of numbers have to invert or at least be equal if you're going to see the kind of turnout. And this is not necessarily party affiliation, by the way. There are people who are in favor of abortion rights who are Republicans and opposed to abortion rights who are Democrats. But you're going to have to see a strong turnout from people who are really animated by this issue, or who are suddenly animated by this issue. I want to quote Heather, who was in one of her other pundit roles. I forget which show I heard her on last week. You were on a couple of them. You were saying, like, who knows? Like, nobody, like, trying to predict election results and election turnouts is such a mug's game anymore. Like, we just don't know what's going to happen here. We can only, like, speculate and perhaps hope.
About the fact that elections have consequences, the New Yorker said, if a majority of Supreme Court decrees that Roe is at its core a subversion of American democracy, then there is some symmetry in the fact that 4 of the 5 justices voting to end it were appointed by men who won the presidency despite losing the popular vote, that 3 of them were appointed by a man who was twice impeached, and that 1 was appointed to an essentially stolen seat. John Hansen, I think, was making the point along these lines that he was really upset about the Electoral College and the fact that that's how we put somebody into the White House rather than just the popular vote. If this is supposed to reflect the will of the people, I mean, what's the purpose or point of a country if it doesn't reflect the will of the people?
Well, you're singing my song here, John, but I don't like the Electoral College. I think that it's extremely anti-democratic. I don't like the way senators are apportioned. I think that's anti-majoritarian. But there is absolutely no chance that the Constitution will ever be amended to get rid of those things. So we have to accept that and move on. There's something like the Democrats have to get like 5% more votes for high office and for congressional seats. They have to get 5% more if they're going to have control of those chambers. Joe Biden won by how many millions of votes, and how close that was. Hillary Clinton, of course, won the election by was it 3 million the popular votes and lost. So it's a disgrace, but it's the hand that we're dealt as Americans.
Do you think that this will make interracial marriages or gay marriage or birth control against the law? Does it go that way as well? Mr. Pearl Clutcher, do you worry about those down the road?
I worry mostly about marriage equality, because some of the same logic that Alito invoked about in his opinion about the opinions that the law needs to reflect the nation's history and tradition, that's he mentioned those in the draft opinion, but he also mentioned them in his dissent in Obergefell, the marriage equality decision. And so I don't think that those rights are, you know, by Alito's own definition, deeply rooted in the nation's history and tradition, so that if a challenge to the, if a state decides, it's not going to happen nationally, but if a state decides, a red state says, we don't want to allow gay marriage anymore, and it goes to the Supreme Court, and you've got the precedent set by the Dobbs case, no matter what Alito may say, he's offering all kinds of soothing platitudes in his opinion, his draft opinion, saying, oh, this is not going to apply to contraception. It's not going to apply to interracial marriage. It's not going to apply to marriage equality. But it really could. I don't think that interracial marriage would be threatened. I can't imagine that.
I don't either.
But some forms of contraception could easily be outlawed, because there is a whole school of thought that says, like, IUDs and some forms of birth control, certainly the Plan B, the morning after pill, that these are abortifacients, that they are implicated in abortions, and that I can easily imagine states acting to ban those. And once you've removed the underpinning of the precedent that supports the laws that say this is none of the state's business what kind of contraception you use, it's none of the state's business who you marry, once you've removed those supporting pillars, those things are threatened, which is why I think that people who are alarmed are not necessarily just catastrophizing this. I think there's some serious issues at play here, and that when you have the religious right in the ascendant the way it is, who knows what could happen.
I know people jumped to talking about marriage equality right after this decision, specifically citing Alito's note on these rights not being, quote, deeply rooted in history. And Alito obviously wrote the dissenting opinion in Obergefell, which is what established that right. But you got to recognize Neil Gorsuch and Brett Kavanaugh, by all accounts, would not be folks who would be overturning that. And Gorsuch, especially, I think, has a pretty solid record on that issue. Mm-hmm. So that, to me, actually is pearl clutching, and I don't think is in the cards on that issue.
I just wanted to go back to that New Yorker piece, because they also talked about the things that are not sufficiently rooted in history. When Roe was decided, a married woman in the United States still needed her husband's permission to get a credit card.
Unmarried woman needed her father's permission to get a credit card.
Something that did not change until 1974. No state outlawed marital rape until 1975. No man was found liable for sexual harassment until 1977. Pregnancy was a fireable offense until 1978. Today we would determine most of those things are impermissible, and they aren't any more deeply rooted than abortion was in the case of Roe v. Wade. I want to move on to what Republican candidate for governor in Illinois, Richard Ervin, who held this first press conference Monday, said, asked about abortion, he said, listen, I'm pro-life. My exceptions are rape, incest, and the health of a mother. But the reporting on his performance generally was more like this from the Sun-Times on whether he voted for former President Donald Trump and whether he'd support another Trump presidential run. Ervin said, that's exactly what J.B. Pritzker wants you to be talking about. On whether he supports a federal ban on abortion, Ervin said, you know, I'm running for governor in the state of Illinois. I'm not talking about what the federal government's going to do. And on the leaked Supreme Court draft opinion that could signal the overturning of Roe v. Wade, protection of abortion rights. Ervin said, I think it's irresponsible for us to hypothesize and speculate on what the outcome will be.
I think it is proof positive that holding only one press conference and then getting frustrated that reporters won't ask you about what you want to be asked about is probably not a top-notch press strategy, because all of the headlines were about Ervin's refusal to answer these questions rather than what he wanted to talk about. It tells you a lot when a politician won't answer questions. I was a little disappointed that he was not asked more specifically if he thought that Joe Biden had been freely and fairly and properly elected president of the United States. That's honestly a more interesting question to me than who he voted for in 2020 or who he plans to vote for in 2024, simply because the governor of each state plays a very important role in certifying the electoral college votes. That's what I want to know. And, you know, we have certainly made offers from WTTW to have him come on the show where I would advocate that he be asked that question.
Is he on the record for having answered it?
He is not.
To anybody? Not at all? He hasn't volunteered that?
No.
I guess there's no upside in the primary to do that, huh?
Heather, this is just what J.B. Pritzker wants you to ask. that was his line. It was really. I listened to the whole news conference. He called the news conference to call attention to the state inspector general's report having to do with the 36 deaths, the COVID related deaths at the LaSalle Veterans Home in 2020, and that was what he wanted to hammer on him for. And then as soon as they opened the floor to questions, the reporter started asking about the draft opinion. They started asking, well, one of the things that Rick Pearson asked him about, a Tribune political reporter, is he said, isn't it disingenuous for you to attack your rivals for the nomination, alleging how they voted, when you yourself, who pulled Democratic primary ballots at least three times, won't say who you voted for? He's sending out mailers calling Justin Sullivan and Darren Bailey never Trumpers. He won't even say who he voted for. And Bailey said, I'm not going to fall into the trap of J.B. Pritzker. And Pearson said, this isn't J.B. Pritzker. These are in your mailers. And he says, I'm not going to fall into the trap of J.B. Pritzker. I mean, it was really a very, very lousy performance by Ervin. He was not ready to answer questions. He needs to get much, much better at answering questions. He got $25 million more from Ken Griffin, so he may not have to face anybody again except the TV cameras in his living room when he makes his next ads. But it was a pretty shot. He deserved the bad press that he got for that news conference, I would say.
I think the gamble, obviously, that his team is playing is they have far more money than any of his opponents and can talk directly to voters without having to rely on really any media coverage of anything they do. I mean, I was surprised that they had a press conference at all. I'm glad someone was talking about the 36 veteran deaths, because that was a huge story. It showed gross incompetence and negligence in the governor's office and the Department of Public Health after a previous report, sort of an outside audit on the process, did not sort of let them off the hook. This report found that multiple requests after a number of weeks from the veterans home to the Illinois Department of Public Health, and they were receiving no guidance and no help from that department, which is extremely concerning.
I agree that was an important report, that this is a really tough thing for Pritzker to have to handle. I'm not exactly sure why Ervin thought it was necessary for him to confront Pritzker with that now, because Pritzker doesn't have any primary opponent.
I'm thinking two press conferences. So that's a press conference to have, and it's points to be scored, but you can't think you're going to control the questions of the media your first time out of the gate.
Right. It's a good issue. It's an important issue. It's a good question. It's also kind of doubly interesting because Pritzker, when he was running against Bruce Rauner, attacked him rather harshly for his performance what he called his lack of proper oversight at the Quincy Veterans Home, where 13 people had died of Legionnaires' disease, and this was all Bruce Rauner's fault. He's an incompetent boob. This is going to be an issue in the fall election. I'm not sure why Ervin thought it was worth risking going in front of the media to make it an issue now. He's got to beat Darren Bailey, Jesse Sullivan, Paul Shrimp. Who am I forgetting?
Well, I've got the list here. In fact, you just moved about a moments ago.
Rabine, of course.
The new WGN-TV Hill Emerson College polling survey of likely GOP primary voters shows Ervin still leading the field with 24.1% support, followed by Bailey at 19.8%. So just over 4% separates them. Suburban businessman Gary Rabine is in third place at 7.8. So 24, 19, and 7. Then Jesse Sullivan, Max Solomon, Paul Shrimp.
I would just say that for somebody who has quite the fundraising advantage, leading in a poll like this by only 4 points has got to be setting off alarm bells at the Ervin headquarters, especially when you look at the fact that you've got people like Gary Rabine and Jesse Sullivan both at just about 8 percentage points each. And I think Gary Rabine is really interesting to me because he has the support of sort of the very hardcore Republican supporters of Donald Trump, including former National Security Advisor and convicted felon and then pardoned Michael Flynn. So, you know, I think that that's a real issue for Ervin, and he is still trying to thread that "I'm not anti-Trump, but I won't talk about Trump" thread. And I don't know if that's sustainable.
I have a question, John. Does it say what the undecided percentage is? Because those numbers
37, almost 37%.
Oh my goodness.
So it's
wow.
A big chunk. And really, and this is the case with all primary elections, but definitely true in Illinois, even despite millions and millions and millions and millions of dollars already being spent telling people, hey, there's election, hey, this guy's running in the election, there's going to be a huge number of people undecided up until the last week before the election. And these numbers are going to swing really heavily.
Well, here's a question for the table. Donald Trump has shown that he still has quite a bit of political muscle. He dragged J.D. Vance across the finish line. I think his candidate in West Virginia, whose name I'm forgetting right now, in the congressional primary there, won Tuesday night. So what would happen if he came in here and threw his weight behind Rabine or Darren Bailey or one of those
Bailey
harder?
Well, yeah, that WGN poll found that 57% of likely GOP voters said they were more likely to vote for a candidate who had been endorsed by Donald Trump. So that is potentially, you know, a game changer. And again, I don't see how Ervin gets that nod from the former president simply because he's supported by Ken Griffin, who's very sort of let's turn the page from Trump. If he endorsed somebody like Bailey, who's already in striking distance, that could prove decisive.
The other thing I would expect if he were to endorse Bailey is you'd have to think, does Rabine, who is also courting Trump's endorsement heavily, just drop out at that point? And if he does, if this poll is accurate, he has some constituency, perhaps big enough to tip it. If it was just a head-to-head, Ervin and Bailey, Sullivan could easily make a surge late, but say it's just between Ervin and Bailey, Rabine supporting Bailey's campaign could mean something.
Well, and we should not underestimate the potency of this far-right vote in Illinois. Remember, Jeannie Ives almost beat Bruce Rauner, came within about 3 or 4 percentage points of beating incumbent multimillionaire Bruce Rauner in 2018.
Yeah.
And she was campaigning kind of on a shoestring. She did not have a lot of money. And like I say, and Rauner was the incumbent.
Well, and do you think that Ken Griffin picked the wrong horse, Eric?
Well, not for what Ken Griffin wants, no.
What does Ken Griffin want? He wants J.B. Pritzker out. Who's most likely to beat him with unlimited money? What if Ken Griffin had thrown all of that money at Darren Bailey?
Oh, boy, it's hard to imagine that he would have done that.
But why not? If job one is get JB out of office,
My guess is that he looked at the past in Illinois. He looked at Governor Thompson, looked at Governor Edgar, Governor Ryan, Governor Rauner, and said, "This is the kind of did I mention Edgar? Who I think I did and Judy Bart Topinka, who was not a governor, but who had a long career sort of in the middle of the political spectrum as a Republican, that he looked at that, at the lay of that land, and said, the person to back in a state like Illinois is someone who is going to appeal to many more moderate voters. I don't know that we're still in that era anymore. I'm not sure that the Republican Party, the Republican voter in Illinois, is like the voters who voted Jim Edgar into office, who voted for Rauner back in 2014. I think that the party has really shifted, and I think that it may have been, we'll see, he may be thrown away, what is it, $50 million so far? Is that what he's given to?
45, I think, was the last 45? Number I saw, yeah. Something like that. Yeah.
So I don't know, but it's I don't, and also I'm not sure if these other candidates, if one of them would have really jumped out as someone who's really, really plausible. But
they could do it all over again. Who's
Kirk
the best?
Dillard was the name that kept popping up right at the beginning, sort of the perennial candidate. But no, I don't think there is any obvious choice other than the folks who are currently running.
I think if somebody like Jeannie Ives had run and gotten the support of Donald Trump, that I think this would have been a very different race. I think the fact that Ken Griffin endorsed Richard Irvin, who nobody knew outside of Aurora, essentially, shows that the bench was not deep, especially because he was clearly looking for somebody who was not, you know, part of the Trump wing of the Republican Party. The question is did Ken Griffin make a bet, a nearly $50 million bet, that there is a part of the Republican Party that in Illinois that is not beholden to Donald Trump? And I don't know that that's a bet he's going to win.
All right, here's two names. Darren LaHood, the 18th Congressional District, who chaired the Trump campaign in Illinois and is a downstate stalwart, and his dad was in the Obama administration as a transportation secretary briefly, kind of a moderate Republican. And then what about one of the Ricketts, Eric? I wonder if one of the Ricketts had decided to run.
In the vein of LaHood, the other big name I forgot about was Rodney Davis, who for a long time was rumored to potentially be running. But after the remap, he was drawn into a district that he could probably win. He's facing Mary Miller in that district. But I think, though, even it's I wouldn't necessarily put the concerns about Irvin purely through a Trump lens. I think there is a large part of the Republican base that looks at some things in Irvin's record that are now kind of starting to be attacked that aren't related necessarily to Trump, maybe aren't even necessarily related to his voting record. But you see these big splashy spends on TV around his comments on Black Lives Matter, for instance, and saying he strongly and passionately supports it. Some of his policy positions in the past on the Second Amendment. I do think some of those attacks, while not necessarily Trump in nature, could help Bailey a great deal in the last sort of 40 days here, as well as Rabin and Sullivan.
There's some money behind this effort to portray him. And I'm not sure if this is the Democratic Governors Association or if this is like Dan Proft and his people, but to talk about Irvin's record as a defense attorney. And I've seen these ads where like he defended a child molester who put out his cigarettes on kids' arms or something like that. I mean, it's like it's really harsh attacks on defense attorneys, essentially. But you have to get that message out, and there's going to be such a flood, a tsunami of Irvin ads in the next, 40 days we have to live through now, Heather?
There are a lot of reasons to have questions about Irvin's record. At WTTW, Paris Schatz has done a lot of reporting on his relationship with Ken Griffin and Citadel, his hedge fund. It's difficult to go from an unknown mayor of a relatively small town in Illinois to be on that, statewide stage. And, the question is, can he pull it out in the next, 45 days or so under really trying circumstances?
Makes you appreciate what Pete Buttigieg sort of pulled off while he was running unsuccessfully for president. He seemed to have the chops, and however good they thought maybe this guy's resume is, he just doesn't have the chops. Irvin just isn't able to play that game, as far as we can tell. President Biden is in town to tell the IBEW convention that the Putin price hike isn't his fault. That's the phrase his team is marching out, the Putin price hike. Joe Biden did not create this inflation problem, but I think it's his problem to fix, or his problem to at least counsel our patience as the machinations of the Fed and other forces work it out. Blaming it on Vladimir Putin sounds more like passing the buck than the buck stops here. And I was really surprised at that. I don't know if we're going to see more of that, but that was the phrase I first read today while he was touring Kankakee and is in Chicago.
I don't think he's got a whole lot else that he can say at this point. I mean, certainly there is inflation all over the world. It's worse, slightly worse here in the United States than it is in other parts of the world where and the conflict in Ukraine, the war in Ukraine, and the supply chain interruptions and all that stuff have increased inflation, as has Fed policy. But the truth is that the presidents don't have a lot of control over inflation. And yet they bear a lot. It's like gas prices. It's presidents are going to own them, whether they have control of them or not. So this is what you have to say. You have to try to figure out someone else to blame it on. You can't say, oh, this is, I mean, they were sort of trying for a while to say, oh, it's temporary. It'll go away.
If you were in that meeting, would you have said, yeah, let's roll out Putin's price hike?
Would I? I'd probably say, let's give that a try. I mean, what else are they going
to
say? Right?
I think they're going to say, wow. I'm not sure what they're going to say, but I would have said, don't say that.
I agree with Eric. There's very little else for them to stand on. I don't know anyone who really believes that after looking at the issue for more than 5 seconds. The U.S. has higher inflation than France, higher inflation than Germany, higher inflation than the United Kingdom. Last I checked, all those countries were closer in proximity and economically more tied to Russia than the United States. So I think blaming Putin is patently absurd. And also, so the other thing is,
but you go with it.
This is
okay.
An anti-science. If we were to talk about anti-science, it's so illogical, the argument. So you have economists from the Federal Reserve saying U.S. inflation tracks pretty closely with the developed world for many, many years. But then something happened in the first half of 2021, wherein the United States started to diverge. And we're printing a ton of money, 40% of the supply of U.S. dollars in the span of roughly 12 months. And also we had massive fiscal stimulus that overheated the economy and kept driving inflation higher. And we know from the data that those stimulus payments drove prices higher. And those are two very large reasons for inflation. It's not, there's many factors, of course, but those are pretty large reasons that were policy choices. And I think blaming Putin is so absurd.
Okay, wait a minute. So you don't roll that out. Eric does roll that out.
I don't know. I probably would. I don't know what else.
How about sucks to be me? I don't know. Tell people the truth or find some way to at least say how we're going to get out of this morass, but own it a little bit then. And by the way, he wasn't the only one that was pro-stimulus. Everybody was, including the previous president. So I don't think it's all his fault. But to say that it's Putin's fault, Heather, I'm putting you in the meeting now. You get to be the...
I say that I've wandered into the wrong room from the press
meeting. Fine.
There are, to the, John, I wouldn't say that. Assuming I have no influence over any of the policy levers, that's the only media spin I can think of that anyone would even maybe close to bite on. Obviously, there's many things you could do on the policy side, for example,
but,
trade policy.
Okay, but it's a load of crap. But the question, I wonder if that even sells. I wonder if people buy that. I wonder if they go, oh, yeah, it's Vladimir Putin's fault because he's invading Ukraine and there's supply chain shortages because of results. So it's Putin's fault. So now, good for you, Joe Biden.
I don't think that that will work. If you have price day to day, to Heather's point earlier about who knows what the issues are going to be in November, people's day to day experiences for the next few months are really going to be affected a lot by these things. And I don't think the first thing they're going to think of when they pass by, you know, a gas sign with $6 gas or see their grocery bill go up or see stuff they need for their kids go up in prices is, dang, Vladimir Putin. They're going to think, what's wrong with the United States?
Maybe we should put them the same way they're going to put that message on the gas station pumps or the receipt about the gas tax. Maybe we should have them say, and by the way, it's Putin's fault. Have that printed right on the receipt.
You're such a cynic, John. It seems to me that, I mean, I'm talking now and putting on a fictional hat of a political consultant, which is like, you sort of have two choices. One would be just to fall on your sword and say, yeah, we overheated the economy too much, that the relief we provided was too much. And we, you know, the economy is more out of control here than it is in other parts of the world. And we have higher inflation. That's why. And we shouldn't have done it. And I'm sorry about that. And we're going to see what we can do to rein things in. And maybe we'll have to raise interest rates. And that's going to cause a different kind of pain. But we're doing what we can. Or you say, well, you know, you blame Putin and then the first message has the virtue of being more honest. But politically, I'm not sure that it sells. I think what they're doing now is they're sort of hoping that some of this recedes and the gas is back around $4 a gallon or even lower than that by the fall. And people go, oh, man, remember when it was so high? Thank you, Joe Biden, for bringing the prices down. I don't know. I mean, it's or they're hoping that the abortion issue will just take over everything. People will say, well, I hate paying $7 a gallon for gas, but I got to protect the rights of my daughter and my niece and my spouse and everyone to have reproductive rights. So I don't know.
And I don't know that the spending that we did to save the economy and people's jobs was a mistake. It was scattershot. But if the alternative was people have no money at all because the government said you had to close, I wonder if, as bad as inflation is now, better this now than that then. We had to do it. And it would have been better if we had a more refined tool, but we didn't. We didn't have the time or we didn't have the resources to really determine who needs how much money. So we just pushed a bunch of money out there. Maybe this is the natural consequence of that, but it doesn't mean that it was a bad idea.
What I dislike about that. So, yes, that's true. And there's massive popular support for it. But then you had senior officials dismissing inflation concerns as sort of a conspiracy and sort of just poo-pooing the whole idea when that should have been made part of, hey, if we do all of this.
Right.
Don't come crying to us in a year when all of your grocery prices.
That's true. Right? I mean, they did. I don't remember that part of the message. I mean, that would have been interesting if they had. That might have even been a good idea, right? If they said, listen, we're going to save your skin now, but you're going to pay for it later. Gas will be $5 a gallon. I want you guys to opine one more topic before we get done today. There's a lot of talk this week about the shape of Alderman Gilbert Villegas's newly drawn ward map. Some call it a tilted pool noodle. He told me it was more like a barbell, long slanted stick with bells on either end running northwest to southeast. He told me Hispanics have been used as backfill for wards in the past, politically disappearing. He didn't sound as angry about it on the radio today, though, as I thought he would. Heather, what's the just overview of his ward particularly and this story generally?
So Gilbert Villegas is the chair of the Latino Caucus, and he was sort of the lead member of the city council who was out there pushing for the new ward map to have at least 15 wards with the majority of Latino voters. Now, that ran smack into the opposition of the city council's Black Caucus, which said that they would not accept that because that meant that it would mean that there would likely be no more than 15 wards with the majority of Black voters. And that is three fewer wards than there are right now. And of course, Chicago's Black population is dropping. So essentially, over the past week or so, with the deadline to avert a referendum over this issue coming to a head on the 19th, everybody sort of blinked, and the Latino caucus blinked first. And what happened was that progressive members of the city council saw that sort of wavering commitment to put the question to the voters, and they made a deal with the Black caucus and white members of the city council. And that deal came at the expense of Villegas, who now represents the 36th ward. And under the new map, the ward would become basically shaped like a pool noodle, stretching all the way from Schorsch Village on the far northwest corner of the city to Westtown along Grand Avenue. And it is, you know, it puts the Jerry in gerrymandering. And that's because it helps shore up the Latino vote in the other Northwest Side wards, which helps other aldermen. And it is just a classic case of how members of the city council have used their redistricting power once again to help themselves, punish their enemies, and boost their allies. And yeah,
here's what I don't understand is that Hispanics actually outnumber African Americans in Chicago. Correct. The 2020 census, there are about 20,000 more Hispanics, and we're cutting up this map so there are, the Chicago United map is 14 majority Hispanic wards and 17 African American wards.
No, so that, it's 16 Black wards, 16 wards with a majority of Black voters, one ward with a plurality of Black voters. That's the 27th ward, which includes the West Loop, and 14 wards with a majority of Latino voters.
So how is that sold as fair if there are more Latinos in the city and they have fewer wards? Well, how do they manage that?
I'm not going to defend it as fair or not fair. I will say that this is one of the starkest remnants of the city's history of segregation that I can think of. So it is not possible to draw a map in Chicago with equal numbers of Black wards and Latino wards. It's just not, because of the way that the city developed. The other thing is that while Latinos might outnumber Blacks in Chicago based on the census, Latinos of who are citizens of voting age do not outnumber Black Chicagoans. And that is a very fraught issue because, of course, we're talking about undocumented people. We're talking about immigrants. And that is why the Black Caucus drew the map, or they support a map that used not just the voting age population, which is everybody over 18, but the citizen voting age population, which is slightly different and favors Black Chicagoans.
I heard Alderman Carlos Ramirez Rosa the other day on Ben Jarafsky's show, and he said that Alderman Villegas folded, that he was the one who was sort of the leader of that Latino caucus, and he folded because he was afraid, according to Alderman Rosa, that about some of the mailings that had been sent to him. This is what we're going to do to you if you don't come over and compromise with us.
What do you mean? This is what we're going to do.
They had some mailings attacking him for being anti-Black, saying that he was fighting with people in the war. They were attacking him for being too close to corrupt politicians, that they were going to make this personal on him. And he folded. This is according to Alderman Rosa. I thought maybe Heather would know more about that backstory, but that it was that Villegas and the Latino caucus just kind of folded under that pressure, that they didn't want a referendum because of that.
What's interesting is that while Villegas was leading this sort of redistricting effort, he's also running to be the representative from the third district of the congressional district. So that put him, you know, that means he had not one, not two, but three different hats that he was trying to wear. And I think that made it very difficult. So would Villegas be able to win the Democratic primary for the third district congressional seat while he was being made the sort of target of sort of a concerted amount of advertising over the redistricting referendum? I think that's an open question. He told me that it was very difficult to try to balance his duties as an alderperson, as head of the Latino caucus, you know, spearheading the remapping fight and running for Congress. It's clear from this map who the winners and the losers was, right? Alderman Villegas was not a winner, because if he loses this congressional primary, he's going to come back to a ward that is very different than the one that he represents now, and that will be very difficult to win re-election to, simply because it is, like I said, it is shaped like a pool noodle. Other losers in this effort include the vice chairman of the Latino caucus, Silvana Tabarez. Her ward is now shaped like a backward C, and she lost Midway Airport. Alderman Raymond Lopez, who's of course running for mayor, his 15th ward is now shaped like an angry person punching somebody. Like, it has two arms and two legs and a skinny body. It is just, you know, it is very interestingly shaped. Now,
fun fact, it's fun to come up with different names for the shapes of the the wards.
Also, a loser, right? Is Englewood still represented by five or six aldermen? I mean, that's another. There's people of Englewood have six different aldermanic offices. Yeah.
Does that not empower them? That is, then you've got five voices whose interests include you, maybe marginally relative to their other parts of their wards. But this may sound naive to you guys based on everything you've said, but for instance, Villegas told us that he feels like he ran opposed last time because he delivers services and it doesn't matter.
Unopposed,
He ran unopposed, and he says, because I'm good at it. And so if I'm representing polls or anybody else, it doesn't matter. I'll be a good alderman. I'm Hispanic. There are other Hispanics dispersed throughout the city who, by the way, will vote in these other wards. So while we talk about the concentration of power geographically, how is that so important?
If you live in Englewood and you could be in one of six different wards, which is the way that it is now and the way it will be under this tentative map.
Yeah.
Unless you can use the city's website or otherwise sort of avail yourself of sort of the institution of city government, you may have very little chance of figuring out even who your alderperson is, much less trying to get them to listen to you. And that is not true for most South and West Side neighborhoods.
The only thing, John, I'd add to that is it's not as if it's this, you know, the neighborhood of Englewood, and then there's six circles within Englewood that are all the aldermen. It's like fingers going into a pie. So they also represent, you know, other areas, which is a classic tactic, especially in Illinois statewide maps, of sorting, having sort of fingers that extend out into the suburbs but capture a significant amount share of the Hispanic vote or the Black vote from Chicago in order to boost Democrat vote share in the map. And I would, just as context for this, the reason all this maneuvering is happening now is to avoid residents being able to vote on what the map is. So we are saying, people of Chicago, you cannot decide what is fair. You cannot decide what the rules of the game are. Chicago City Council actually really knows what's politically fair. They have a great history of, you know, sort of racial justice and equity and what is politically fair. We should have them decide what the map is instead of you. And I think that's just, their record speaks so to the contrary of that, that I don't know how aldermen can go back to their constituents and say, yeah, we're really pro-democracy. Yeah, we're really pro-cleaning up city government. And we're going to do this the exact same old school way. You get no voice.
Yeah. What was the deadline, Austin? When did they have to have this done by before that happens?
May 19th.
Right. Yeah, I mean, there was. Yeah. Let's close with this last email from a listener. And by the way, you can always email the Mincing Rascals. Just send it to, say, me, John Williams, at WGNradio.com. It says, first, is Steve Bertrand going to be able to join the Rascals again, please? Steve was a longtime member of our panel, and he is not going to be able to join us. And number two, about Roe v. Wade. I agree with Eric Zorn last week in that it is a private decision. As I was walking tonight for exercise and listening to the Mincing Rascals, I had a thought. I want to know if Roe v. Wade was overturned. What if a new caveat was stipulated? She would need to carry the baby to term, unless, of course, for rape or the health of the woman, etc. But the man involved would have to have his reproductive organs removed to not be able to produce sperm ever, no matter the age of the man, from 6 to 126. Not just a vasectomy, but physically removing the testicles so no sperm could ever be produced ever. I think a lot of people would stop and really think about this situation. Now it would be saying, well, a woman's body is not her own and government could now control it. But a man's body is no longer his own and the government would now control that as well. Teenagers to mid-40s and on up, it wouldn't matter. Love the show. Signed, Brian Vernon Hills.
I do not endorse castration.
Fair
enough. I'm going to clutch my pearls.
Fun fact, Eric does not support castration.
I do support Steve Bertrand. I know.
I wish he could join us more regularly.
We didn't fire him. We love him.
No, he is invited, but powers greater than ours will not allow him to make the time in his day to do this. But I'm glad that Austin Berg, Heather Sharon, and Eric Zorn did this week. We're produced by Pete Zimmerman. Okay, guys, good job. Thank you. We'll drop another podcast on you next week.
Great seeing everybody. That was fun.
It was fun.
That was a lot.
I gotta go find my pearls now and get some serious questions.
Eric, you should do that next week. Wear pearls and clutch them during the podcast.
I was going to make a castration pearls joke, but I did not think it was appropriate. Don't clutch them too hard.
All right, I'm turning you guys off. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Subscribe to the Mincing Rascals podcast on iTunes or the Google Play Music Store. You can now also follow us on Spotify, or you can keep listening online at WGNradio.com.